Don't you know that those who serve in sacred matters eat from the temple, and those who attend to the altar share in what is offered on the altar? In the same way, the Lord ordered that those who preach the gospel should make their living from the gospel. He makes great effort to demonstrate that the act of receiving was not prohibited. Having previously stated as much, he was not satisfied, but proceeds also to the law, providing an example more relevant than the previous. For it was not the same to reference the oxen and to cite the law specifically given concerning priests. But please consider this in Paul's wisdom, how he mentions the matter in a way to give it importance. For he did not say, "They who serve in sacred things receive from those who offer them." But what? "They eat from the temple, so that neither those who receive may be criticized, nor those who give may be praised." Therefore, what follows he has written in the same way. He did not say, "Those who serve the altar receive from those who sacrifice," but rather, "They share in what is offered on the altar." For now, the offerings no longer belong to those who made them, but to the temple and the altar. He did not say, "They receive the holy things." Instead, "They partake of the temple," again emphasizing their modesty and that they should not seek to make money or become wealthy. And even when he mentions that they share with the altar, he isn't implying an equal division, but rather the provision given to them as their due. However, the situation of the apostles was much more intense. While the former case involved the honor of priesthood, the latter encompassed dangers, massacres, and violent deaths. Therefore, all the other examples together still couldn't match the saying, "If we have sown spiritual seeds among you," since by saying "we sowed," he illustrates the storms, the peril, the traps, the indescribable evils which they endured while preaching. Nevertheless, even with such immense superiority, he had no intention of diminishing the things of the old law or elevating his own. In fact, he even downplays his own, ascertaining the superiority not from the dangers, but from the magnitude of the gift. For he did not say, "If we have risked ourselves or exposed ourselves to traps," but "If we have sown spiritual seeds among you." As much as possible, he elevates the role of the priests, saying, "Those who serve the sacred things and those who serve at the altar," aiming to highlight their constant service and patience. Just like he had talked about the priests among the Jews, including both the Levites and the chief priests, he has mentioned each of the ranks, both the lower and the higher, the former by saying, "Those who serve the sacred things," and the latter by saying, "Those who serve at the altar." For not everyone was commanded to do the same task. Some were entrusted with the rougher, others with the more elevated duties. Therefore, understanding all of this, lest anyone should say, "Why are you talking to us about the old law? Don't you know that our time is of more advanced commandments?" After all those subjects, he presented the strongest of all, saying, "Even so, the Lord decreed that those who preach the gospel should make their living from the gospel." Nor does he even here say that they are supported by men, but as in the case of the priests, of the temple, and of the altar, so here of the gospel, and as there he says, "Eat, so here, live, not make merchandise, nor lay up treasures. For the laborer," he says, "is worthy of his wage." But I have not used any of these things. What then if you have not used them now, one might say, but plan to use them in the future, and thus you state these things? Not at all, for he promptly addressed this assumption by saying, "And I'm not writing these things so that they may be done in my situation." And see with what intensity he denies and rejects the thing, "For it would be better for me to die than for anyone to make my boasting meaningless." And it isn't just once or twice, but many times he uses this phrase. Earlier he said, "We didn't use this right," and later, "So as not to misuse my right," and here, "But I haven't used any of these things." These things? What things? The many examples, meaning multiple things giving me permission. The soldier, the farmer, the shepherd, the apostles, the law, the deeds done by us to you, the things done by you to others, the priests, Christ's command. None of these have convinced me to renounce my own rules and accept offerings, and don't refer to the past, but I don't rely solely on it, and also concerning the future, I commit myself, saying that I would rather starve to death than lose these crowns. "It would be better for me to die," he says, "than for anyone to nullify my boasting." He didn't say that anyone should abolish my law, but my boasting. for fear that anyone should say, "He does it indeed, but not happily, but with sorrow and grief." Eager to demonstrate the extent of his joy and the abundance of his enthusiasm, he even describes the matter as boasting. So far away was he from worrying himself that he even boasts and would rather die than lose this boasting. Even dearer to him than life itself was this proceeding of his. Next, he praises it from another perspective as well, implying that it was a significant thing not to make himself appear renowned, but to indicate that he rejoices and with the intention to fully remove all doubt. For this reason, as I previously mentioned, he also referred to it as a glorying. And what does he say? "For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast about, for a need is placed upon me. For disaster is unto me if I don't preach the gospel. For if I do this by my own choice, I have a reward. But if not by my own will, I have a responsibility entrusted to me. What then is my reward? That when I preach the gospel, I may deliver the gospel of Christ free of charge, so as not to fully use my right in the gospel." What are you saying? Tell me. If you preach the gospel, you don't have any reason to boast unless you're doing it for free in the name of Christ. So, is this greater than that? Absolutely not. But from a different perspective, it does have some benefits. One is a command, whereas the other is a voluntary act of kindness. Acts that go beyond the commandment generate a significant reward, while those that merely fulfill a commandment, not as much. From this perspective, he says, one act outweighs the other, but not in the fundamental nature of the action. What can equal preaching, since it inspires people to even compete with angels? However, one is a commandment and an obligation, while the other is a voluntary act of goodwill. This makes the latter superior in this regard. This is why he explains what I just mentioned. If I do this willingly, I have a reward. But if unwillingly, a responsibility has been given to me, emphasizing the words willingly and unwillingly, whether it's assigned to him or not. And so we should interpret the phrase, "for necessity is imposed on me," not as if he ever did anything against his will, far from it, but as if he were obligated to obey the commands, a contrast to the freedom mentioned previously in acceptance. That's why Christ also said to his disciples in Luke 17:10, "When you've done everything, say, 'We are unprofitable servants. We have merely done what was our duty.' So what is my reward? That when I preach the gospel, I can do so free of charge. Now are you saying Peter has no reward? Indeed, who could ever have as great a reward as him? What about the other apostles? Doesn't it say, 'If I do this willingly, I have a reward, but if not willingly, I am entrusting a stewardship'? Do you see his wisdom in this? He didn't say, 'But if not willingly, I have no reward, but a stewardship is entrusted to me.' This implies that even in this case, he has a reward. But it's more like the kind received by someone who fulfilled his commandment, not like the one given to someone who generously used his own resources and did more than the commandment required. What then is the reward? That when I spread the gospel, he says, I can present the gospel without charge, not fully utilizing my right within the gospel. Notice how he repeatedly uses the term right, indicating, as I have often noted, that those who receive are not deserving of blame. But he mentioned in the gospel, in part to demonstrate its fairness, but also to prevent us from taking this matter to extreme in all cases. Because the teacher should receive, but not the unproductive one too. Even though I was free from all people, I made myself a servant to all so that I might win over more. He introduces yet another significant step forward. For it's even a great thing not to receive, but what he is about to mention is much more than that. So what does he say? I have not only refrained from receiving, he affirms, I have not only avoided using this right, but I have even made myself a servant, and in a servitude that's comprehensive and varied, because not only in terms of money, but, which is more significant than money, in numerous and varied tasks have I upheld this same rule, and I have made myself a servant even when I was not subject to anyone, with no obligation in any regard, and I have not been a servant to just one person, but to the whole world. That's why he also added, I enslaved myself to everyone. That is, I was commanded to preach the gospel and proclaim the entrusted matters, but devising countless additional things, that was all due to my own enthusiasm. I was only required to invest the capital, whereas I did everything possible to gain a return for it, doing more than what was asked of me. Thus, doing everything out of voluntary effort and passion and love for Christ, he had an endless desire for the salvation of mankind. That's why he would always greatly exceed the set limitations, soaring higher than the very heaven in every possible way. Next, after discussing his servitude, he outlines the different forms of it in the following section. And what are these? Verse 20. And I became, he says, like a Jew to the Jews, so that I could win over Jews. And how did this occur? When he circumcised to abolish circumcision, that's why he didn't say a Jew, but like a Jew, which was a wise strategy. What are you saying? The ambassador of the world who reached the very heavens and shone so brightly in grace, does he suddenly descend so low? Yes, for this is to ascend. You should not only focus on the fact that he descended, but also on how he lifted up the one who was bent over, bringing him up to his level. To those who are subject to the law, as though being under the law myself, despite in reality not being, with the intent to win over those who are under the law. This either explains the previous statement, or it suggests something additional to the previous idea, naming those individuals as Jews, who were originally and historically so, but labeling those under the law as converts, or those who became believers yet still clung to the law. For they were no longer strictly Jews, still under the law. And when was he subject to the law? When he shaved his head? When he offered sacrifice? These actions were done not because of a change of heart, but due to his compassionate love. In order to successfully convert those who were truly Jews to this belief, he mimicked their behavior, appearing as such but not really embodying it, nor acting out of genuine conviction. Indeed, how could he, being so eager to convert others and only performing these actions in an effort to liberate those who did practice them from that disheartening situation? Verse 21. To those who are without law, as without law. These were neither Jews, nor Christians, nor Greeks, but outside of the law, like Cornelius, and if there were any others like him. For among these individuals too, showing up, he would adopt many of their customs. But some suggest that he is referring to his conversation with the Athenians from the inscription on the altar, and that's why he says, to those who are without law, as without law. Then, so no one would think that he had simply changed his mind, he clarified, not being without law to God, but under law to Christ. Meaning, far from being lawless, I'm not simply bound by the law, but I observe a law that is far more exalted than the old one, namely the law of the Spirit and of grace. This is why he added, to Christ. Then, once he had made them confident in his judgment, he shared the benefits of such humility, saying, so I could reach those who are outside the law. He continually explains his humble approach and doesn't stop, saying, verse 22, to the weak I became weak, so that I might gain the weak. In this part relating to their situation, in consideration of which all these things have been mentioned. However, those were much greater things, but this is more relevant, from which he has positioned it after them. In fact, he did the same thing also in his letter to the Romans when he was criticizing about meats, and so in many other instances. Next, to avoid wasting time by individually naming each one, he says, I have become all things to all people, so that by all means I might save some. Do you see how far it has gone? I have become all things to all people, not expecting, however, to save everyone, but hoping to save even if it's just a few. And I have taken such great care and effort as one naturally would who is about attempting to save everyone, far from hoping to win over everyone, which is truly noble and a sign of intense zeal. Just like the farmer who sowed his seeds everywhere, he did not save all the seeds, even though he did his part. And having mentioned the few who are saved, he added, by all means, to comfort those who might find this discouraging. For although it's not possible that all seeds will germinate, it also cannot be that all should die. Therefore, he said, by all means, because someone who is so passionately eager must surely have some degree of success. And I do everything for the sake of the gospel, so that I may share in it. This means that I hope to also seem to have added some of my own contribution, and may share in the reward set aside for the faithful. For as he spoke of living of the gospel, that is, the believers, so also here, that I may be a joint participant in the gospel, that I may be able to partake with those who have believed in the gospel. Can you see his humility? How in the assignment of rewards he positions himself as one of many, even though he had outdone everyone in his efforts? From which it is clear that he would also excel in his rewards. However, he doesn't insist on enjoying the prime reward, but expresses contentment if he may partake alongside others in the rewards prepared for them. But he's saying these things not because he did this for any reward, but that he might lure them in this way, and by these hopes might encourage them to do everything for their brethren's sake. Do you realize his wisdom? Do you notice the superiority of his morals? How he went beyond what was commanded, not taking when he was allowed to take? Can you see the tremendous extent of his humility? How he, who was under law to Christ and kept the highest law to those who were without law, was as one without law to the Jews as a Jew, outperforming and superseding all in both circumstances? Also, do this, and don't believe that you're making yourself inferior when you humble yourself for the sake of your brother. This is not falling, but rather descending. One who falls stays prostrate, barely able to get back up again, but one who descends can also rise again with great gain. Like Paul, he descended alone, but ascended with the entire world. He wasn't pretending, for he would not have sought the salvation of others had he been acting. A hypocrite desires the downfall of others and pretends in order to receive, not to give. But not the apostle. Like a doctor, a teacher, a father to the ill, the student, the child, he humbles himself for their improvement, not for their harm. And so should you. To prove that what has been said is not just pretense, in a situation where he is not forced to act or say anything, but intends to express his affection and trust, listen to him saying, "Neither life, nor death, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus our Lord." Do you see a love more passionate than fire? So we should also love Christ. Indeed, it is easy if we wish to. For the apostle himself was not this way by nature. This is why his previous life was documented, detailed in such a stark contrast, so that we may realize that this devotion and transformation are a matter of choice, and that everything is easy for those who are willing. Let's not despair then, but even if you're a slanderer, greedy, or whatever you might be, keep in mind that Paul was once deemed a blasphemer, persecutor, abuser, and the topmost of sinners, yet suddenly ascended to the pinnacle of virtue. His past lifestyle didn't impede him. There's no one who clings to vice with as much madness as he did when waging war against the church. In fact, he was so enthusiastic that he became upset when he realized he didn't have 10,000 hands to stone Stephen with. Nonetheless, he managed to metaphorically stone him with even more hands, the hands of the false witnesses whose clothing he kept. Moreover, his impact was like that of a wild beast when barging into houses, dragging men and women out, filling surroundings with chaos, confusion, and endless clashes. For instance, he was so fearsome that the apostles, even after his incredible transformation, were still hesitant to associate with him. Despite all this, he became the man we know. I don't need to say more. Where now are those who argue the inevitability of fate against the freedom of will? Let them hear these words and be silenced. Nothing stands in the way of one choosing to become good, even if they were once among the worst. In fact, we are more naturally inclined towards good, as virtue aligns with our nature and vice opposes it, just as health aligns and sickness opposes. God gave us eyes not to lust, but to admire His creations and worship Him. It's clear from what we see that this is the purpose of our eyes. We can see the brilliance of the sun and sky from incredible distances, yet we can't discern a woman's beauty from far away. Do you see that our eyes were primarily given for this purpose? Similarly, the ear was made so we could hear not blasphemous words, but doctrines of salvation. Thus, when we hear discordant speech, both our soul and body recoil. As said in Ecclesiasticus 27:5, "The talk of him that swears much makes the hair stand on end. If we hear cruel or merciless words, our skin crawls. If kind and dignified words, we rejoice. If our mouth utters indecent words, we feel ashamed and seek to hide. But if serious words, we speak them freely and comfortably. We don't blush for things that align with our nature, only for things that oppose it. When our hands steal, they hide and seek excuses, but when they give charity, they boast. Therefore, if we choose to, we are naturally inclined towards virtue from every angle. But if you argue the pleasure derived from vice, consider that virtue provides even greater joy, the pleasure of having a clean conscience, being respected by all, and holding optimistic expectations is unmatched by any other for those who understand the true nature of pleasure. Conversely, being scorned by everyone, accused by our own conscience, and living in fear of both the present and future is the most grievous for those who understand the nature of pain. To make my point more clear, let's imagine, just for the sake of argument, a man who is married but contaminates his neighbor's marital bed, taking pleasure in this wicked act of theft and indulging in his mistress. Then let us compare him to another man who loves his own wife. And to make the triumph even more significant and noticeable, let the man who only loves his own wife also have a desire for the other woman, the adulteress. But he controls his passion and does nothing wrong, even though this arguably isn't fully chaste either. However, giving more than is required shows just how fulfilling the joy of virtue can be, which is why we've set up this hypothetical situation in this way. Now, having gathered them, let's ask them, whose life is more pleasing? You will hear one take pride and rejoice in his victory over his lust. But the other, in fact, there is no need to wait for him to say anything. For you will see him, deny it as many times as he wants, more miserable than men in a prison. For he fears and suspects everyone, his own wife, the husband of the adulterer herself, his servants, his friends, his relatives, walls, shadows, even himself. Worst of all, his conscience is echoing within him, barking loudly every day. If he also remembers God's judgment, he wouldn't even be able to stand. His pleasure is short-lived. However, the pain from it is endless. Every evening, during the night, in the desert and the city, everywhere his guilt haunts him, showing him a sharpened sword, threatening an unbearable punishment, undermining and consuming him with fear. But the chaste person is free from all this. He is at ease, and he calmly looks at his wife, his children, his friends, and he meets everyone with an untroubled gaze. Now, if a person who is in love but still controls his desires enjoys such great pleasure, a person who doesn't indulge in such a passion but is truly chaste, how tranquil and serene must the mind he achieves be? This is why you see few adulterers but many chaste people. If the former were more pleasurable, it would be chosen by more people. Don't tell me it's the fear of the law that stops them, but the unreasonable extent of it, and the fact that the pains of it outdo the pleasures. Also, the judgment of the conscience. This, then, is the adulterer. Now, if you will, let's bring forth the covetous, exposing another lawless passion. For him, too, we shall see fearing the same things and incapable of experiencing genuine pleasure, remembering both those he has wronged and those who empathize with them, along with the public judgment of everyone about himself, he has 10,000 worries. And this is not his only distress, but he can't even enjoy his cherished possessions, for such is the nature of the greedy. They do not possess things to enjoy, but rather to lack enjoyment. But if this seems like a conundrum to you, listen to what's even worse and more puzzling. They are not only deprived of the joy of their possessions by their fear of using them as they desire, but they are also perpetually unsatisfied and live in constant desire. What could be more torturous than this? The righteous man, however, is not like this, but is freed from fear, hatred, and this insatiable desire. And as all people curse the former, so do all people unite to bless the latter. And as the former has no friend, so the latter has no enemy. So, given these acknowledged truths, what can be more displeasing than sin or more pleasing than virtue? Even if we were to discuss it indefinitely, no one could adequately express either the painfulness of sin or the delight of virtue until we experience it ourselves. For it's only then that we find sin to be more bitter than gall after we've fully savored the sweetness of virtue. It's not that sin isn't already unpleasant, disgusting, and burdensome. Even its very followers can't deny this. But it's only after we distance ourselves from it that we most clearly recognize its bitter demands. If many people are drawn to sin, it's not surprising. After all, Children often prefer less pleasant things and ignore those that are more delightful, and sick people routinely sacrifice lasting certain joy for temporary indulgence. But this behavior is a result of individual weakness and foolishness, not the inherent nature of things. After all, it's the virtuous person who truly enjoys life. They're the ones who are truly wealthy and free. But if anyone would grant all other things to virtue, liberty, security, freedom from worries, fearlessness, trust in others, but refuses to admit that it offers pleasure, to me, laughing and emphatically at that, seems to be the only option. For what is pleasure if not the release from worries, fears, and depression, and the absence of subservience to anyone? And tell me, who is in pleasure? The man held captive in frenzy and spasms, driven by various desires, not even in possession of himself, or the one who is liberated from all these turmoils and finds peace in the love for wisdom, like in a safe harbor? Isn't it apparent that it's the latter? This seems to be a feature unique to virtue. Thus, vice simply holds the title of pleasure, but lacks its essence. Before indulgence, it's insanity, not pleasure, and right after indulging, it dissipates instantly. So, if one cannot discern its pleasure either in the beginning or afterwards, when and where would it appear? And so that you can better understand what I am saying, let's explore the strength of our discussion with an example. Consider this. A man is infatuated with a beautiful and attractive woman. As long as he can't have her, he behaves like a man who has lost his mind, verging on insanity. But once he achieves his desire, he has satisfied his craving. Therefore, if he doesn't experience pleasure at the beginning, as his situation is madness, nor at the end, as he calms his wild desires with the fulfillment of his lust, where exactly can we find the pleasure? However, our actions are different. From the start, they're free of any disturbance, and the pleasure stays vibrant until the end. In fact, our pleasure doesn't have an ending, our good deeds don't have a limit, and this pleasure never fades away. Considering all these aspects then, if we love pleasure, let us grasp virtue so we can gain good things both now and in the future, to which may we all achieve through the grace and mercy, etc.